Welcome to Now You Know Politics. I'm Catherine Sussman.
And I'm Rob Laidlaw.
Today, we will be discussing Canada's passing of Bill S-203, the ending of captivity of whales and dolphins, and what that actually means for the current cetaceans in captivity in Canada today. Then, we will talk about how this kind of a law makes us rethink the practice of having other wide-ranging species in captivity, in particular, elephants, and how they are one of the most ill-suited, perhaps, of all animals in Canadian zoos. This episode will have you thinking, why free whales but captive elephants? Thanks for listening. Rob, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Great. So I think what we should do today is just start off by following up on what we were talking about last time, considering the huge news that we've had earlier last week, the passing of Bill S-203.
Yes, it's something that certainly hit the media and was extensively talked about in social media as well. So very timely topic.
So yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, this is something that so many people have put so much work into for many, many years. Now we officially have this precedent-setting animal welfare bill that's passed, you know, federally. It's wonderful. It's an end to captivity of whales and dolphins in Canada, which means an end to the wild capture. That won't ever happen again. It's actually going to be criminalized to hold them in captivity, an end to breeding of the animals that are currently in captivity. But the question of the day that everybody wants to know, for me and I'm sure you and everybody involved in this, is how does this exactly really realistically help the current whales and dolphins we still have here in Canada? How does this help Kiska? How is this helping the over 50 belugas that are crowded at Marineland?
I don't think it really does. Possibly the only way that I could see that it might rectify some of the problems faced by some of those animals is if it creates pressure on the facilities here in Canada, particularly Marineland, of course, because they have most of the whales and dolphins. But if it puts pressure on them and causes them to consider moving those animals elsewhere, then there's a chance they could be going to better conditions or enhanced conditions in other facilities. Of course, there's also a flip side of that. There's a chance that if they do that, they could go to facilities that are not as good as Marineland. So in real terms right now, though, I think it's very much like Bill 80 that the Ontario government passed that banned orcas. Great move, largely symbolic in the case of Ontario, and easy for the government to do. But, you know, because Kiska, the orca, was grandfathered, it didn't help Kiska at all. And that's unfortunate in the Ontario case with Bill 80. And I think it's unfortunate in this case. And there are, you know, many mitigating factors for why the government did what they did. But it would have been nice to see something happen with the existing animals. But obviously that didn't. So now we're faced with the prospect of what do we do as advocates for these animals if we feel that they're in conditions or circumstances that aren't optimal for them? What do we do to try to help them? So I think that's where the discussion will go very, very soon.
But unlike the provincial bill, Bill 80, that passed, where enforcement just never occurred because the OSPCA simply wasn't able to enforce, not enough funding, not enough specialists, et cetera. With this, because it's federal law now, it will be enforced at least to some degree in terms of no more breeding of the animals. Is that correct? So who will be the enforcing body and what will that process look like? Will that mean birth control for the belugas? Will that mean separating males from females, pulling apart family members? Can we just get into the nitty gritty a little bit?
I think that's a question that a lot of people are asking, is how will enforcement be delivered and by who? And I haven't heard a very good answer. Certainly when you're looking at the trade side of things, so permitting and all of that with regard to import and export, then it's going to be at a higher level. It will be the Canadian Wildlife Service, the CITES office, and Department of Fisheries and Oceans. But when it comes, you know, down to the level of on the ground, who's going to make sure that the whales at Marineland are not breeding? I don't think there's an answer to that question yet, but that will obviously have to be worked out. As to how Maryland will do that, you know, there are suggestions of chemical birth control methods. I don't know the veracity of those methods or how successful they are, but apparently it has been talked about. And of course, they're separating males from females and, you know, doing other kinds of things like that with regard to the daily and seasonal management of the animals that can mitigate some of the attempts that these animals make to breed. But how it will all play out, you know, they always say the devil is in the details, and I think that is still the case right now and remains to be seen. There's got to be an enforcement regime. It should be kicking in very soon so that additional females don't become pregnant, you know, thereby extending the length of time that animals are, you know, going to be procreating and producing more. So, you know, again, you know, since the bill's so brand new, I haven't heard any concrete discussion about how this will all play out. But certainly, I think all of the people who have worked on this will be advocating for some type of mechanism to be put in place very soon so that we see an end point for the births at Maryland and, you know, full delivery of the intent of the bill itself.
And would it not be a welfare issue to just separate males and females? These are a group of animals, like a pod, essentially, that have been living together for so many years.
I don't think there is going to be significant welfare issues. We've heard from Maryland and from others that, you know, these animals have established social relationships and, you know, to break them apart. And I think Andrew Burns in the Senate committee meetings and other places had said, you know, rip apart families and used expressions like that. I don't think that's a legitimate concern. We have to remember that these are animals that were either born there or caught from the wild, that the social groupings they're in are entirely arbitrary. They don't have an ability to leave the tank and go join other belugas like they may in the wild, because belugas generally live in what are called fission fusion families or societies where there's a bit of influx and outflux of individual animals. So the entire situation is artificial and arbitrary already. So I think it's sort of disingenuous for people to say, well, we're going to break apart families. Well, they're not families.
You know, but having said that, for example, you said there are a bunch of babies about to be born. If they're going to eventually separate males and females, what about calves being separated from mothers? And, you know, is there going to be some set of criteria for a time frame in which that can happen? Sorry to get too detailed, but like these are real questions that people want to know the answers to.
In terms of the management of the animals, I have not seen anything in that regard. You know, I think the bill's addressing things that are at a more basic level.
Right. Yeah.
And they're not dictating to the facility how to comply with the law. They're just saying you have to do it. So, you know, again, I think so much of this will be forthcoming in the near future. People will be advocating for it. And I'm hoping that even prior to the bill passing, that Maryland had been working on a plan, you know, to make sure that they do comply. And in fact, in an article I saw yesterday, they said they would be complying with the law. So perhaps they've actually got an idea on how they're going to do this. But, you know, none of us are able to see that just yet, because that's up to Maryland to let people know.
Well, I think we definitely just need to take a moment to kind of savor at least the symbolic victory here, and that it's really a reflection of Canadians' views and like the changing tide when it comes to how Canadians feel about animals. People are becoming ethically aware, and it's really encouraging to see. And I personally think, you might correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think that this will set the stage for, you know, advocates to make really convincing arguments for other far-ranging or deep-diving, other far-ranging species that just don't do as well in captivity, that don't fare as well in captive conditions.
Well, that's certainly a concern of the zoo and aquarium industry. They see many of these types of things, whether it's elephants or whales or polar bears, as the thin edge of the wedge. And in fact, if you look through their literature, their blogs, their journals, you often find them saying, okay, these animals are going, what's next? What's next? What's next? So it's a very real concern in the captivity community. they see so many of these things as setting precedents that will lead to yet another and another species being challenged. So I think that's a good thing. I think they should see it as a good thing. They should evolve with the times. If public sensibilities are changing, if the science is changing as well with regard to the welfare of these animals, then they should be going with that and evolving. But unfortunately...
But the best zoos aren't they? A lot of the really good ones are putting an end to the practice of certain species in captivity, such as the ones you just mentioned.
I don't believe that.
Okay.
I think they're fighting tooth and nail to maintain the status quo. There's not a zoo association anywhere that I know of that has acknowledged that whales shouldn't be in captivity, that has acknowledged that elephants shouldn't be in captivity, or even in urban settings where, you know, you have a very small zoo footprint and not a lot of space for these animals. There's no zoo organization that I know of that's acknowledged that certain kinds of animals should not be in captivity.
Really? So what about Ron Keegan and everything that you hear about, you know, like the Detroit Zoo and all of these?
There's 10 to 12,000 zoos in the world, about 1,200 of them being what are called core zoos that have professional staff that are potentially or are currently members of their regional or international zoo associations. There's a few out of those 10 to 12,000 that are outliers. They don't represent the industry as a whole because they have a slightly different perspective than, you know, their counterparts. So you can point to the Folsom City Zoo, the Detroit Zoo on some issues, Oakland Zoo. There's a few like that where you can say, well, they hold a different view on some of these issues, and they do, but it's important to remember that they are outliers. They are exceedingly rare in that community. So I don't think you can look to them and say that, hey, you know, this is being acknowledged, because it's not. It's not. Not yet, anyways.
So one of these species that those outliers do recognize as being ill-suited to captivity is elephants. So I thought we could now, we just launched on Now You Know, a couple of elephant podcasts, and I was thinking we could move into talking about current events in the news in regard to elephants, both African and Asian.
Yeah, absolutely. I think elephants are one of those animals that are on the list of the most inappropriate animals to keep in captivity, and I think there are people, if they're not accepting that they shouldn't be in captivity, that they are at least engaging in that discussion now. And as we've said, there's been a few facilities that have taken the step of actually saying they're going to phase out the keeping of elephants, or they have already done that. And in a very tiny number of cases, they've sent their elephants to sanctuaries. I think that's a trend that will grow. I think it's inevitable. But right now, like I said, there's still a lot of resistance by the zoo movement by the zoo industry to, you know, openly engage and acknowledge that, hey, you know, elephants shouldn't be here, and maybe giraffe shouldn't, and maybe polar bear shouldn't. But I think in time, those discussions will occur.
And I think the public is really coming around to, you know, having the information and understanding. So it's interesting because Jen and I, after I had interviewed Dr. Winnie Kiru on African elephants, and that's what we've just put up, Jen and I were discussing our various childhood experiences with being taken to the zoo. And I was pointing out that it was so beautiful and really quite a shock to me to hear Winnie Kiru discussing elephants and seeing elephants in the wild as, you know, the natural way to see elephants. And just thinking back to my childhood, to me as a Canadian child growing up in Toronto, the place that you went to see an elephant that was natural was literally the zoo. It was the Toronto Zoo. I mean, that was where an elephant was supposed to be. I didn't question it. I had grown-ups taking me there, you know, I'm not meaning to be doing the wrong thing, but just not thinking about it. So I think with this whale bill passing and now, you know, people like Winnie speaking out, more advocates speaking out, I do think that the public attitude is changing.
Absolutely. And there's all kinds of things. You know, we've been involved in a number of movements of animals like the Toronto Zoo elephants, but also other animals and other zoos. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion from people from all perspectives when these things occur. And certainly we're seeing a growth in a different kind of perspective, one that sort of bucks the traditional one that just accepts that keeping these animals down the street in a zoo is normal. So I think, you know, that's going to grow. That's going to grow exponentially. And what we have to do as people who are concerned about these issues and as advocates for animals is to see that there are political follow-ups when those perspectives change and grow and become the majority perspectives of society. We have to do all that work that then sees that reflected and manifested in the political arena as well. But yeah, definitely it's growing. And each time one of these things happens, that just adds fuel to the fire.
So a couple of other things I wanted to talk about with you, get your opinion on in regard to elephants, just in terms of the welfare issue. I know you've done a lot of work on elephants in Japan and that there are lots of solitary elephants in Japan. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about foreign countries currently, and maybe you want to stick to Japan, I'm not sure, but the wide gamut of which ones have regulations that they follow, which ones don't. Elephants generally, like globally, where are the worst problems? Where are we going right? Which countries are doing it well?
That's a difficult question. I don't think anybody can do it very well. I think if you're going to look at instances of captivity where animals have, you know, a minimal quality of life, then you're definitely going to be looking at the elephant sanctuary. So you would be looking at places like the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee, the Paz sanctuary in California, elephant sanctuary Brazil run by Scott Blaze, and a few of the others that are around the world. There are some in Thailand. There's one proposed. I think it's under construction in Europe. There's the third one being constructed right now in the United States. I think, you know, if you're looking for, you know, what's good out there in the world of captivity for elephants, I think you really have to look at those kinds of situations. There's a lot of bad out there. You know, there are horrendous situations for elephants that are very much analogous to what you see in Japan. In Eastern Europe, there are elephants that are poorly treated in captivity throughout Southeast Asia. There's elephants poorly treated in Japan, as you mentioned. And now, right now, I think there's about 14 or 15 solitary elephants in Japan.
Okay.
So there's a lot of bad out there. What that usually means, how it is manifested in reality is, you know, animals, and it might be one, it might be a pair, it might be even more than that, kept in very small, very behaviorally impoverished kinds of environments, hard surfaces, management styles that really don't follow in any way, shape, or form the natural rhythms of life for elephants.
I was reading something about how in the wild, elephants have 16 to 18 hours a day where they are active and in captivity. They're locked up essentially when the zoo is closed. They're locked up for about that amount of time every night.
Well, or even more. You know, we know of many cases, and that includes in Japan that we've mentioned, where when the keepers go home or are getting ready to go home at 4 o'clock after their 8-hour shift at the zoo, they will then chain the elephants in their stalls. And those elephants are in there until 9 or 10 the next morning. So they're spending sometimes 14, 16 hours a day in a stall or on chains, and then are let out into their display area.
Is that still happening in North America?
It's still happening. There are a lot of elephants that are sequestered at night. And, you know, it really is sort of antithetical to everything that elephants are, because if you look at elephant families, you'll see that they, as you said, elephants don't sleep very much. Most elephants will sleep just for 20-minute increments over a period of about 4 hours at night. So they're active the rest of the time, 18 to 20 hours a day, socializing, moving, foraging, doing elephant things. And in the zoo, even the better zoos, you know, if they're sequestering their elephants at night, you know, that's contrary to what elephants really do. When the keepers go home, they don't stop being active. You know, they want to continue being active. So they should have, you know, space and complexity and flexibility and an ability to make choices for those times when keepers may not necessarily be there actively managing the animals. So
I guess that's what increases aggression, isn't it? If they have all that pent up energy, and it would be particularly problematic in Canadian zoos where, you know, our winters are so cold. Some of these elephants, like Lucy in the Edmonton Valley Zoo, it's just so cold there. I'm assuming she has to be indoors a lot of the time.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you've got elephants in northern zoos, then, yeah, you've got the additional problem of, you know, the winter period. And, you know, I know the American Zoo and Aquarium Association says, or I believe they did have a standard where when it's below 40 degrees Fahrenheit, which I think is about 5 degrees Celsius, that you would probably want to bring your elephants in. There's a bit of leeway in that, you know, individual institutions can really choose what they want to do. But yeah, for the most part, in cold weather environments where zoos are located, definitely the elephants are indoors a lot of the time. And if they're already keeping the elephants indoors at night for management purposes, then, you know, that's compounded with the additional time because of the cold in the winter for those animals. So it's a pretty bleak circumstance.
I wanted to get into the topic of Asian elephants versus African elephants, because I think often, you know, when we think about problems associated with elephants in the wild, we are thinking African elephants, poaching, the ivory trade. But I don't know if, does the ivory trade also apply to Asian elephants? It could, I don't know.
It does, but to a lesser degree. I think the key problems for Asian elephants are human-elephant conflict. So
yes,
you've got, you know, very, very large numbers of people in many Asian countries, many of them poor, and they're competing for the same space as elephants. So inevitably, you know, unless governments step in and do the right thing, inevitably that space that elephants inhabit will be slowly withered away, you know, sort of the death by a thousand cuts. Or in some cases, the elephants may just lose out and they'll be out of luck and they'll end up being killed or forced elsewhere. Although most of these habitats in Asia are quite fragmented, so there's not corridors for elephants if they're under pressure from human disturbance or human development in one area to move to another. So it's a different set of problems, but equally severe. And there's only about 40,000 Asian elephants left, so it's not a lot of animals.
And this is why I wanted to bring it up. I actually spoke at my niece's school on elephants because she started a club and they were showing. She started an animal welfare club, actually, and the club gave a screening of the film Love and Bananas. I don't know, have you seen it?
No, I have not seen the film yet.
It's a really, really good film, and it really emphasizes that the plight of the Asian elephant has really been kind of overlooked. I mean, just Asian elephants as service animals, Asian elephants as usually the elephants that we're looking at in zoos, the elephants that people ride on at zoos, the elephants used in circuses. Is that correct? That often they are, in fact, Asian elephants? So these are the elephants that we have the contact with.
Yeah, the majority of elephants that you see in captivity are Asian elephants. And certainly when you look at places like India, Burma, and other countries, there's a very long history of keeping elephants for various kinds of uses, sometimes agricultural, sometimes in the old days, they were animals that were actually brought onto the battlefield in wars. They were used for transport in the Vietnam War and other more modern wars for soldiers moving through the jungle and for timber operations throughout Asia, you know, where there wasn't that level of mechanization that would allow people to, you know, remove large amounts of timber in these very difficult places. They would use elephants and still do to a certain degree. So there's this long history of uses that you don't see that kind of use reflected in African countries. And certainly, as you said, the plight of African elephants of both species has been one that's sort of overshadowed the challenges faced by Asian elephants, primarily because of the scale of the problem in Africa. You know, there's about 400,000 elephants left, with about 90 a day being poached for their ivory tusks. So that's generated a lot of concern by advocates and by people in the public all over the world. So I think the immediacy and the scale of the problem in Africa is what's caused the problems of Asian elephants to be overshadowed.
On a practical level, though, how effective is the ban?
Well, I think the ban's been very successful. And if you talk to elephant conservationists, and actually I know somebody who was involved in getting the first ban in place in the Lausanne, Switzerland CITES meeting back in 1989, it resulted in a drastic decrease in the numbers of elephants that were being poached. But what people often forget is just passing a law, whether it's in an international treaty like CITES or whether it's a domestic law, it's not enough. You have to have enforcement. And what's happened, particularly in Africa, if you have criminal syndicates and militias that are poaching elephants to sell the ivory to fund their criminal operations or their wars. their civil wars. And, you know, so governments need to step in. They have to realize it's not enough just to have something written on paper that says, hey, you can't trade this. You've got to fight these criminal syndicates. You've got to have an investigative staff and policing staff that deal with that. You've got to fight these militias that are moving into parks and other areas and killing these animals for profit so that they can buy weapons and fund their own operations. You've got to do education as well. So, you know, having the law is great, and it did result in this drastic decrease, but there's been this creep back up in numbers and in poaching. And it's something that governments, especially in elephant range states, have to proactively and aggressively try to address.
Well, just to again try to end on kind of a more positive note, because there's so many problems going on in the world. And perspectives are changing, right? So here we have this great bill, and there's others on the Hill that, you know, might go through as well. And there's hope. There's hope in the changing mentality of Canadians and other people around the world.
There's hope, but I want people to realize that this is just the beginning. These are very, very small steps. We've got a long way to go, but there is hope.
You just won't let me end on a positive note. That's okay. Anyway, Rob, it was great as usual to chat with you today and learn from you. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.